From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. We're pleased this morning to have with us Jake Sullivan, who's visiting from the United States, visiting us here at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing. You'd be hard-pressed, in my opinion, to find somebody more influential in the democratic foreign policy community. In the Obama administration, Jake had significant influence on President Obama's foreign policy and was Hillary Clinton's point person during the presidential campaign on foreign policy. He served in the Obama administration early on as director of policy planning and was a close advisor to then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as her deputy chief of staff. In the second term, he moved over to the White House, where Jake was deputy assistant to the president and national security advisor for Joe Biden. He was involved in many of the most important and key foreign policy initiatives of the Obama administration, including with the president of the Carnegie Endowment, Bill Burns, then Deputy Secretary of State, leading the secret negotiations with Iran that ultimately led to the Iran nuclear agreement. We're very lucky to have Jake at the Carnegie Endowment now as a senior fellow in the Geoeconomics and Strategy Program. This is a new program that is looking at the intersection of national economic policy and foreign policy, and addresses what Jake has identified as a disconnect in U.S. grand strategy in terms of linking our foreign policy with our national economic interests. Jake, thanks for joining China in the World podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Jake, my first question is, why this new program at the Carnegie Endowment? Why this Geoeconomics and Strategy program? What is it that you, what is it that you and Bill Burns, saw as a gap in terms of our foreign policy and our national economic interests?
Well, there are two basic realities out there today that motivated Bill and myself and my colleagues in the program, including Salman Ahmed and others, to launch this new geoeconomics and strategy program. The first fact is a foreign policy fact, and it's that power in the world is increasingly being measured and exercised in economic terms. And other significant countries in the world, including China, see economic power as a core part of their statecraft, as a core part of their national security strategy. And the question for the United States is, what could we be doing differently to advance our national security objectives through the use of economic influence and economic tools? The second fact, and this is something that I felt both in government, but even more acutely working on the campaign for Hillary Clinton, is that the core challenge facing the United States and other advanced economies is how we strengthen and sustain a the vitality of the middle class. And there has been a gap, in my view, between the way that we think about our foreign policy priorities and the things we do abroad, and delivering a stronger, healthier middle class at home. And so the second question we'll be looking at is, how can we take steps in terms of our foreign policy and national security strategy that puts the middle class at the center of our decision making? And that's a major project we're looking at over the course of this year.
You know, if you consider your program and you look and you bring the discussion here to Asia, one of the examples you've given is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which during the campaign, then candidate Donald Trump said if he was elected, he would pull out, which he did in his first week in office. In the discussion of TPP in the United States, is this an example of how we didn't put forward an effort that was important for strategy and connect it with why it was important in terms of our domestic economic programs and jobs to Americans?
I think the TPP issue, and both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump came out against TPP during the campaign, is an example of where the strategic community, the American strategic community, foreign policy experts, almost across the board, Democrats mm-hmm. and Republicans said, this is a good thing. This is, in fact, an essential thing for American leadership in Asia. And I certainly agree that a multilateral trade agreement that sets new rules of the road for the Asia Pacific and ultimately sets the groundwork for new rules of the road globally mm-hmm. Is an essential part of American strategy. But the specific terms of TPP, I think, were not presented to the American people in a way that gave them confidence mm-hmm. that at their core, they were going to improve wages, increase jobs, and deliver benefits for the middle class. Now, we could have a debate about whether that's true or not mm-hmm. true, but the fact is that I think we in the strategic community and the national security community need to do a better job of both understanding the elements of our international economic policy and then connecting that to a larger narrative about how, at the end of the day, it places priority on a healthier, more vibrant middle class mm-hmm. in the United mm-hmm. States.
I want to talk to you about Asia, but before I do that, you know, President Trump during the campaign expressed very different views about America's role in the world, U.S. foreign policy, very different from previous approaches to foreign policy, both Democrat and Republican, where we had a more traditional role of American leadership. I just want to get your sense on, you know, do you think, and we're seeing now President Trump carry out many of the things that he talked about in terms of the promises on how he would change America's approach to the world. One, is he on to something? Is there something that we need to consider going forward, whether he's president or not, in terms of adjusting our approach to these issues? And even when he's not president, if we have a more traditional candidate come back as president, will the landscape change on these issues? Will we ever go back to normal? Or are the kind of issues that he's put forward that we're now considering, is that going to change the way we look at American leadership in the world today?
I think Donald Trump has, in a way, done a service for the foreign policy community in both the Democratic and Republican parties. He's forced us to ask very basic questions about mm-hmm. why we do what we do in the world, and what is working and what is not working in terms of American leadership. And I think we would be remiss if we simply rejected out of hand yeah. every question he put on the table and said, it's all working perfectly. We don't have to worry. We don't have to change anything. In fact, I think the way that he critiqued American leadership and American foreign policy, and our immediate response was kind of to go into a defensive crouch, yeah. just went to show that we haven't done the kind of fresh thinking and reexamination of some yeah. of the assumptions that have underlied our approach in the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration. So I do think we need to make adjustments. But mm-hmm. fundamentally, I think Donald Trump's prescriptions are wrong. For right. example, he has questioned the value of alliances. And I mm-hmm. think at the end of the day, America's alliances around the world are one of our great strategic assets. He has questioned whether we should care at all about the promotion of values overseas, right. values of democracy and human rights. And I think if the United States sets values aside entirely and becomes just another normal country out there, our ability to influence the rest of the world or to inspire people elsewhere in the world will come at a cost yeah. to our security and our prosperity. Yeah. He has rejected the idea that there should be multilateral solutions to right. anything. He wants right. all bilateral transactionalism. And most of the great challenges we face today, whether it's climate change or nuclear proliferation or the potential for a future global economic crisis, they require collective action by multiple countries all working together. And that collective action requires a leader, requires someone to step up and mobilize cooperation. And the United States is the only country capable of doing that. That's yeah. in our interest yeah. and it's in everybody else's interest. So on these core principles, I think Donald Trump is wrong mm-hmm. and the bipartisan consensus is right. But how we actually practice that mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. prioritize that in the world, that's where we need to look to make some adjustments.
And that's specifically many of the issues that your geoeconomics and strategy
exactly.
probably look
at. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that his diagnosis that the conversations around the table in the Situation Room and in the halls of our major foreign policy and national security agencies have gotten a bit adrift of the core question of what it's going to take to protect and enhance America's most vital asset, which is a strong middle class, that diagnosis is a fair diagnosis, and that we need to think about what should we be doing differently. But we need to do that while maintaining a basic foundation of our alliances, our friendships, and our leadership role in the world, and not give those things up.
You know, a lot of people, as President Trump, you know, is retreating in a number of areas of global leadership for the United States, whether it's climate change or the Iran nuclear agreement, which you were a part of, or the global trading and economic system. A lot of people are talking about China is now stepping up to fill that void. You know, I'm skeptical, number one, that China will be able to fill that void or wants to fill that void. You've been out here now for a couple of days. How do you see that dynamic?
Well, I share your skepticism. I mean, at the end of the day, it takes a unique actor to play the role of the mobilizer, the catalyst for international cooperation on these big issues. It takes an enormous amount of effort. It takes cajoling and browbeating and persuading countries to sign up to make commitments to help solve these big global problems. The United States has filled that role for a while. I think it will continue to do so because there isn't anyone else, China included, who has either the wherewithal or the willingness to do it. And so what I fear is that if we continue down the road that President Trump has put us on, we're just going to end up with drift and decay. We're not going to end up with a replacement leader.
In your experience in the Obama administration and what we've seen in the first year of the Trump administration, where is it that you see China stepping up in terms of playing a larger global role? And how is their calculus in wanting to do that or willing to do that different than the way the U.S. approaches global leadership in the past?
I think anytime anything happens anywhere in the world, it is the instinct of Americans to say, how do we help solve that problem? And how do we solve it in a way that works for us, but also kind of works for everybody else? A real positive sum mindset. That's just kind of part of the American instinct. I would say it's part of the American character generally, and it's part of the American foreign policy character as well. I don't see China as having reached a point where it proceeds in any way like that. They continue to focus on how to protect Chinese interests, both in the region and globally. So to the extent that they are, quote unquote, stepping up on big issues, it's where they see their interests implicated and where they feel they need to take steps in order to protect those interests, whether that's economic interests or the interest of the security of their personnel in places like Yemen or South Sudan or what have you. But
I think climate change could be the best example.
And with respect to climate, why is China doing what China's doing to a large extent?
You look at the air here in China, the polluted rivers and life.
So it would take a real significant shift for China to actually inhabit the personality or the purpose of a global leader. And I just don't see that shift happening anytime soon. Now, here in the Asia Pacific, I think China believes that it has both the right and the opportunity to take on a much more significant role, and that it would prefer to see the United States play a role that is somewhat diminished from the role the United States has traditionally played. But there, I think what the U.S. and China need to do is sit down and have a structured strategic conversation about how we arrive at terms of coexistence in this region so that it works for them, it works for us, and it works for everybody else.
Let's talk for a few minutes about President Trump's approach to Asia. We're coming up on the end of his first year in office, and I'm interested to hear from you your views on where President Trump has shifted away from previous approaches, whether that was in the Obama or Bush administration, and where he's maintaining a consistent approach from previous administrations. In terms of the consistency it seems alliances is something that he's put forward as important for America's approach in the world. Do you see consistency there in his approach with alliances?
To a much greater extent in Asia than in Europe. And that's because nothing focuses the mind quite like North Korea marching towards a nuclear ICBM capability. I think that's what's made him believe he's got to invest in Japan and South Korea in particular. I think it's been a little scratchier in his relationship with Australia, you know, going back to the phone call he had with Malcolm Turnbull. But basically, the story on alliances in Asia is more one of continuity than change.
And from that standpoint, on his recent trip out here, his first stop was Tokyo.
Right.
Second stop was Korea.
Yeah.
And then he came to China. And I agree with you. I think that made a lot of sense and put our China policy in a broader Asia context, which was important.
Yeah. I do worry, though, that he doesn't think the same way about how these alliances form the foundation for a broader regional strategy, the way the previous presidents have, that he sees them mainly through the prism of North Korea right now and not as much through the prism of an integrated regional strategy. But that may change over time. We'll have to wait and see. Where I think that he has been quite different from previous American presidents is in his approach to issues like values, democracy, and human rights. He's demonstrated in Asia that his favorite people are the ones who are the most autocratic and that he's simply not going to raise or press the values question with any of the leaders in this region. I think he's also been significantly different in terms of his rejection of multilateralism. He views multilateral arrangements as fundamentally constraining of American sovereignty. So he walked away from TPP. He has put very little focus or emphasis on the institutional architecture of the region, the East Asia Summit or APEC or ASEAN. And he thinks about everything in bilateral and transactional terms. And I think that will come at a cost because, you know, as you were just saying, a good China policy, the end of the day, is a good Asia policy. And a good Asia policy is a policy that involves thinking about our relationships in this region, not as one-offs, but as part of an integrated whole.
Yeah.
And I hope over time that the people around Trump can convince him that looking purely through the bilateral and transactional lens will ultimately come at a cost to America's role in this region.
And you know, you saw that play out in practice on the second half of his trip to the region, where the first half was approaching Japan and Korea and talking about the importance of the alliances and the importance, frankly, of the China relationship with the China stop. But then he seemed to really deviate when he went to APEC and he went on to the Philippines for the U.S.-ASEAN summit, and he almost got to the East Asia summit. He didn't quite get there at the end of the day. But that's where, in my mind, you see a real departure from the traditional approach. And I worry about that as well, in that it doesn't send a message, a reassuring message, of America's credible commitment to the region.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you think back to the previous two administrations, a Republican and a Democratic administration, we all worked hard to build a foundation that said there's going to be some features to American leadership. One is that we are going to stand for a set of universal values, and we're going to call out leaders like Duterte in the Philippines who are in severe breach of those values. Two is we are going to invest in the institutions of this region because we think that that is the way that you're going to promote an open and fair trading system, the way you're going to promote collective problem solving for these challenges that no one country can solve on their own. And it's going to be the way that we encourage China to become a more responsible player and to rise into a rules-based system that works for everyone. And I think walking away from that or not seeing the value in that, you know, maybe the cost isn't present, you know, when he got on the plane to fly home, but that cost will become apparent over time.
They put forward this concept, the Trump administration did during the trip, of this Indo-Pacific strategy. And folks out here in the Asia-Pacific, especially here in China, are trying to better understand what this is beyond just a sort of a bumper sticker. I was somewhat pleased at hearing the administration use Indo-Pacific, only because, as you said, I share your concern that Trump looks at the Asia-Pacific and thinks China. And then beyond that, when he thinks China, he thinks North Korea.
Right.
And that's not, in my mind, a credible approach to the region. It's not good for American interest. So I was pleased on one hand to see, okay, now they're looking at the region from a broader standpoint, in a broader context. But beyond that, I didn't really see anything. And I wonder if you had a sense of where this might go in the Trump administration, and how do they fill this bumper sticker out, put meat on the bones of this?
Well, my assessment is that they've essentially fashioned this phrase for purposes of giving the trip some kind of overall tagline. Mm-hmm. And if you press Donald Trump on what does the Indo-Pacific mean, he might not even have been aware that Indo-Pacific was meant to be
more
the,
of his,
the defining
national
theme of the trip.
Security
this
foreign
is more
policy team
his team. But look, I think they could end up putting it into practice because the fundamental insight of the phrase Indo-Pacific is an insight that I think is a valuable one, which is we have to think about the expanding geography of this region to include the Indian subcontinent, that India is an active player in the affairs of East Asia and the Asia Pacific. And so from my perspective, there's some value in it. But to actually see it be converted from a bumper sticker to an actual strategy will require a lot more work than we've seen so far.
You can see a security component to this. I know this was an idea that came to the Bush administration in 2006 from the Japanese, from Abe himself. The Pentagon liked certain elements of it in terms of security cooperation with partners in the region. But the issue that you raised about Trump's departure from the values piece, that seems to me would be a huge gap in the Indo-Pacific strategy. And then, Jake, how does the administration put forward a credible trade and economic component of this Indo-Pacific strategy if all they're putting on the table is a bilateral trade agreement?
That's right. I mean, if you thought about those three pillars, the pillar of sort of democracy, human rights, shared values, you'd see an alignment among India, Australia, Japan, the United States, potentially some other actors in the region as well. If you look at the economic dimension, you could see a multilateral effort to raise the rules of the game, to lift the standards in the region. And on both of those, there doesn't seem to be any instinct on the part of the president and any policy being put forward by the people around him that would really give content to the strategy. On the security part, starting in the Bush administration and then picking up in the Obama administration, where we had the trilateral dialogue among India, Japan, and the United States, I think there is actually now a richer reservoir of cooperation. The U.S. and India are collaborating on a security basis to a greater degree. Obviously, the U.S.-Japan alliance is very firm in trying to now integrate some of the exercises and other potential common security activities is something you could see the Trump administration take forward. But if you're a three-legged stool that where two of the legs aren't really yet put up underneath the table part of it, that's just going to fall over. So in order for this to work, the Trump administration is going to have a more comprehensive approach than what we've seen so far.
Jake, let's talk about North Korea. When you hear what the administration is talking about with regard to North Korea, including General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, you could come to the conclusion that this administration is laying out a case for war. You could also, however, look at this and say, well, if the Trump team wants to get to the table and negotiate with the North Koreans and be able to have leverage to make progress, they need to convince the North Koreans that they have military options that they're willing to use. Which is this? Are they really considering military options, or is this part of an effort, psychological operations campaign, to convince North Korea and China that they have military options and they're willing to use them?
Well, as you and I both know from having served in government, if you're not actually in the room, you're basically speculating. And so I'm only speculating, but I'm speculating based on a now pretty significant body of statements by this administration and arguments and the unfolding of a logic around the North Korean nuclear issue that all, in my view, points in the direction of them being serious about considering the military option, that this is not just a bad cop routine. It's not just raising the specter of military force as a means of coercive diplomacy, but that they actually are contemplating the use of military action to respond to North Korea's advances. And the two things that have stood out to me in that regard are, one, the argument that they are making, both publicly and privately, that North Korea cannot be deterred in a traditional way, and therefore we can't have a strategy that just tries to contain and deter them, which points in the direction of military action. And the second is that they believe that they have viable military options that could manage the escalation risk. And when you put those two together, that suggests that there is at least a group of people inside the administration who are making the case that if it comes to it, war might be an acceptable option with respect to North Korea. And I think 2018 will be a decisive year in seeing how that debate plays out in the administration.
The Obama administration looked at the issue of military options and whether they're credible military options. How did that debate come out in the Obama administration?
Well, I think that the emphasis at the time from military leaders, intelligence officials, and the whole national security team was on the consequences of taking preemptive action in North Korea, the likelihood that you would end up seeing a North Korean response that resulted in massive casualties in South Korea. And we have 28,000 troops in South Korea. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of thousands of U.S. citizens in South Korea. So this is a highly dangerous, costly, and risky proposition to think about taking military action in North Korea. Now, the Obama administration, like the Bush administration, never took military force off the table, nor should you take these options off the table. There are circumstances where the risk calculus is such that you'd have to contemplate it. The question is, are we in one of those moments now? And I have my doubts about whether the administration has really thought through the consequences of military action. And I'm worried that we may end up just talking ourselves in to a military campaign that could end up not achieving its purposes, but at the same time bring with it enormous human cost.
So you think that as they examine this question of military options, that perhaps they don't have an appreciation for the significant cost? Is it in some way in your mind a different calculation that they have to consider, which is, you know, if the North Koreans are on the 1 yard line of getting this capability to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon, or is if they said last week that they have this capability, is it then a consideration of what are the costs of being vulnerable to this North Korean capability versus what are the costs associated with taking a preemptive military strike approach? Are they weighing the costs, or in your mind, is it really a function of they don't understand what the costs are for military options?
I think that in the way that they have publicly laid out the case for the viability of military options, they are aggressively downplaying the costs.
Yeah.
And that concerns me.
Yeah.
It'd be one thing if they said, yes, the costs are going to be enormous, the escalation is going to be enormous, but frankly, we just can't live with it, so we're going to have to deal with a catastrophe in Northeast Asia because that's better than the alternative. That's not the argument. I don't necessarily agree with that, but that is not the argument that they are making. Mm-hmm. They're making an argument that says, we think there's a way to do this that comes at a more limited price tag in terms of human life and overall strategic disruption in the region. But beyond that, I think the other challenge of what's happening right now is because of the increasing flirtation with the potential military option, there's not enough thought being given to what remaining window is there for diplomacy and what might that diplomacy look like. Mm-hmm. And what I would like to see is the administration saying, before we even get to the question of choosing between very unattractive options, is there any way to put a lid on this now? And having served in the Obama administration, And obviously, this is an issue you worked on very intimately as a part of the six-party talks. You know, I'm mindful of not criticizing this administration for not making progress because successive administrations have not been able to stop North Korea from getting to the point that it's arrived at now. But I basically believe that the window for diplomacy has not fully closed, and that shifting to a mindset of, well, we're going to end up having to go to war here, is premature. And I hope the administration is considering what its options are on the diplomatic side.
As you look out to 2018, obviously North Korea is will continue to be an urgent issue. What else do you see on the U.S.-China agenda? You know, in many ways, you could say the first year of the Trump administration, the Chinese must be relieved because all of the things he promised he would do to move to a much tougher approach with China never came to fruition. How do you see 2018 in that regard?
Well, North Korea is going to play loom large, even on with respect to the economic issues, because if we do end up escalating our way towards a military confrontation with North Korea, I think it will put a lot of these economic issues on a side track.
Sure.
But projecting out from 2017 to 2018, I think the table is set for a much more aggressive set of American actions and significantly more scratchiness in the U.S.-China economic relationship. And that's true for a couple of reasons. First of all, after the administration gets through this tax reform process at the end of this year, there is not a clear next step in terms of their domestic legislative agenda. And so I think Trump will be tempted to focus more abroad to score some wins that he can bring home. Secondly, with the midterms approaching, the issue of China and the impact of China on American jobs will become more political. Mm. And I think Trump is going to feel some pressure to deliver for his base and show that he, in fact, has gotten tough with the Chinese on certain issues. Third, you're seeing these Section 301, Section 232 actions come to a head, and the Chinese will have to respond to those in some way. And so when you stack all of this up, I think 2018 is setting up to be a year in which the United States is likely to act more aggressively towards China on certain economic issues. And my fear is that that will get us into a tit-for-tat scenario that could end up being quite negative for both sides. But that's all of this, I think, is something that both American policymakers and Chinese policymakers are going to have to factor in.
Well, Jake, thank you very much for sharing with us your views and insights and for being with us for the China in the World podcast and for the Distinguished Speaker Program. We hope you come back to Beijing soon.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.